The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, by Robert A. Caro, Part 3, continued. In dealing with these men, Johnson did not make the slightest effort to paper over this conflict in his fundraising efforts, nor was it necessary for him to do so. Political philosophy played not the smallest role in his appeals for money. During the next congressional campaign in 1942, after Ed Flynn had again attempted to freeze him out but had again been thwarted by Johnson's control over Texas money, replied oil man G. L. Rousey to a Flynn plea for funds, "My delay in replying is due to the fact that I expected to be in contact with our congressman, Honorable Lyndon Johnson. I desire to know his wishes in this matter and to make my contribution to or through him." Johnson, exasperated by Rayburn's continued failure to understand the new realities, wrote the speaker that "these $200 driblets will not get the job done." What was needed, Johnson said, was to select a Minuteman group of 30 men, each of whom should raise $5,000, for a total of $150,000. This should be done between now and next Wednesday. There isn't any reason why, with the wealth and consideration that has been extended, we should fall down on this. The logic behind that advice was the logic of Mark Hanna. Mobilizing the business community against the threat of Bryan and the populist philosophy embodied in his candidacy, the boss of Ohio raised political contributions to a new level in 1896 by transforming campaign financing, in the words of his biography, from a matter of political begging into a matter of systematic assessment according to the means of the individual and the institution. An assessment in which each great insurance company, railroad, and bank would pay according to its stake in the general prosperity of the country. Dollar Mark made campaign financing, in other words, a political levy upon wealth based straightforwardly upon gratitude. For past government help in acquiring that wealth and upon the hope of future government protection of that wealth and of government assistance in adding to it. Johnson's fundraising, not being for a presidential race, was on a much smaller scale than Hanna's, but it was based on the same naked philosophy of pure self-interest, the wealth and consideration that has been extended. And, as had been true in the case of Hanna, who raised millions more for a presidential campaign than had ever been raised before, Johnson's logic was irresistible to those, oilmen and contractors, at whom it was directed. His confidence that the $150,000 could be raised in 5 days was justified. It was, and it was distributed just as rapidly to those candidates Johnson selected. If Herman Brown regarded the campaign contributions he funneled through Lyndon Johnson as an investment, he received a healthy return on it. Neither Herman nor his brother George had ever seen a ship being built. "We didn't know the stern from the aft, I mean the bow, of the boat," George recalls. Nonetheless, in 1941, at about the time that their Corpus Christi Naval Air Station contract was rising toward $100 million, the brothers were awarded a lucrative Navy contract to build 4 sub-chasers. The brothers established a new corporate entity for the purpose. Says George, "They needed a name to put on the contract, and I said Brown Shipbuilding. That was all there was to it." When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, the 4 sub-chasers were not yet completed, but a Navy Department official told the brothers, "We'll put you in the destroyer business." During the war, Brown Shipbuilding, under contracts with provisions so favorable that profits were all but guaranteed, would carry out $357 million worth of work for the Navy. And what of the return reaped by the oil men on an investment in Lyndon Johnson that, as years passed, was to grow and grow? What did they want from government? They wanted a lot, not only continuation of the oil depletion allowance and of other tax benefits, and of exemption from federal regulation, but new benefits and new exemptions, and other new favorable government policies. As the future will demonstrate, they wanted government favoritism on a scale so immense that it would become a significant factor in the overall political and economic development of the United States. In 1940, they had not yet achieved what they wanted, but they were asking too early, that was all. Lyndon Johnson wasn't their senator yet. Chapter 33. Through the Back Door. In order to reap the fullest benefits from his work with the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, Johnson kept working after Election Day. Among the implements he employed were letters, letters with the Johnson touch. These letters, written to powerful officials, all shared a single theme. Each official was told that it was he and he alone who had made it possible for Johnson to participate in the 1940 campaign. Each official was thanked, humbly, gratefully, for giving a young man his great opportunity, and each official was flattered, with flattery custom-tailored by a master of the art. Johnson had noticed how entranced Henry Wallace had been at Longley by his stories about Texas. To the vice president-elect, Johnson wrote, "When Texas was fighting for its independence, there were several squirrel shooters from the hill country who heard the news and wanted to get into Sam Houston's army. They couldn't find old Sam himself because he was busy outmaneuvering the enemy, leading him into a trap. But they had friends who took them in hand, set them out over the right trails, and landed them at San Jacinto, where they could witness the action and in their small way participate. I am a successor of some of those squirrel shooters, and in 1940, 104 years afterwards, I was in a similar quandary, not very strong, but smarting to add my few grains of powder to the battle fire. I have not forgotten that you showed me the right trail and helped set me out on it. With congratulations and assurances of my confidence in and affection for you, sincerely, Lyndon Johnson." John McCormick had a tradition he was proud of, the Massachusetts tradition, which included Bunker Hill. And to the majority leader, Johnson wrote, "You helped me get in line and to see the whites of a few enemy eyes. I shall not forget it." "Until I ran across you," Johnson also wrote, "it looked as if the undersigned Texas boy from the hill country wasn't going to be able to get in with his few rounds. The big guns were all roaring, and I didn't know whether I was going to find a loophole through which to point my muzzle loader." The key to Sam Rayburn was the speaker's protective paternal feeling for young men who depended on him, and Johnson wrote Rayburn, after telling him that it was only through your good offices that I had the chance to participate in the campaign, that some young congressmen would have been out in the bitter winter wind without firewood if you and other veteran hands hadn't pitched in, accomplished the necessary, and effected their rescue. Letters from this prince of flatterers went not only to men who, like McCormick, had indeed helped him get into the fight, but to men who, as he was well aware, had tried to keep him out of it. To Ed Flynn he sent a letter of felicitation and appreciation. "The fighters in the ranks give thanks not only for the victory, but for the leadership which brought them the victory. As one of the infantrymen, I rejoice in the victory and in my officers who arranged it. And I thank you warmly for your consideration in the midst of an incredibly busy time, consideration which made it possible for me to get in my few licks. Call on me at any time I can do anything, and remember me." The most important of these letters began with the simple salutation, "Sir," and told Franklin Roosevelt, "There wasn't much I could do to help when the Battle of 1940 was raging, although I smarted to do something. I know I should have been utterly out in the cold except for your good offices. You made it possible for me to get down where I could whiff a bit of the powder, and this note is to say thank you. It was grand. The victory is perfect." During the 1940 campaign, Roosevelt and Johnson had had several discussions. Now they were to have more. The president and the young man talked together in the Oval Office. One can only imagine Lyndon Johnson's feelings during those conversations, in that bright, sunny room in which he had for so many years longed to sit. And they talked together in the upstairs, private quarters of the White House. Johnson had breakfast in Roosevelt's Spartan bedroom, the president sitting up in bed with a blue navy cape around his shoulders. He had lunch in the president's private study, a comfortable room with chintz-covered furniture and walls so full of naval paintings that they seemed almost papered with them, dining with Franklin D. Roosevelt off a bridge table. Johnson, describing the president as a lonely man whose wife was often traveling, is quoted as saying, "He'd call me up, and I used to go down sometimes and have a meal with him." External evidence reveals that one subject they were discussing was Texas, for Roosevelt was, more and more, making Johnson his man in that state. The individual through whom political matters relating to Texas were cleared. These included minor details seemingly far removed from Johnson's immediate interest. A note requesting a letter of presidential greetings for an East Texas banker was referred by the president not to Sam Rayburn or Jesse Jones, or to the banker's congressman, Lindley Beckworth, but to Johnson with a covering note. "You think this is all right to do?" Johnson's suggested reply was followed exactly. And they included matters not minor at all and very close to Johnson's heart. With Garner departed and Rayburn tarred, Johnson's major remaining rival for the role of the president's man in Texas was Reconstruction Finance Corporation Chairman Jesse Jones. A symbolic confrontation came on Jones's own turf, financing that involved RFC bonds. The bonds in question were those of Alvin Wirtz's Lower Colorado River Authority, $21 million of which had been purchased by the RFC to help the authority get underway. Superlatively safe investments, because the authority's now ample revenues were pledged through unbreakable bond covenants to pay the interest and amortization, high-yielding, tax-exempt, these bonds were coveted by investors. "I think every bond house in the United States is waiting to get its hands on the Lower Colorado River Authority bonds," Wirtz was to write to Johnson. Wirtz had his own favored bond house in mind, but Jones had another, and he had the power to sell the bonds to whom he chose, and was about to exercise that power when, at a cabinet meeting, the president handed him a scribbled note. "Private. J.J. Don't sell the Lower Colorado River Authority bonds without talking with Father. F.D.R. What this meant was that some moocher had been to see the president looking for an inside deal, Jones wrote in his memoirs, meddlers wanting to muscle in for a little private smoosh. He also wrote that he defied the president and sold the bonds to the highest bidder. But in fact, Roosevelt's intervention dissuaded him from making the sale he had intended, and eventually the bonds and the smoosh went to the firm favored by Wirtz and Johnson. What else Roosevelt and Johnson talked about, we don't know, just as we don't know how often they actually talked alone. Did they talk politics? This master of politics who had persuaded a mighty nation to grant him ultimate power for an unprecedented span, and this wonder kid of politics who was searching for every possible handhold on the path to power? Did they talk personalities, these two matchless readers of, and manipulators of, men? No one really knows. All we know is their reaction to their discussions, reactions revealed to others. Lady Bird Johnson says her husband saw Roosevelt often. She says, "I, of course, know nothing about what transpired between them at these meetings, but I know the mood they left him, her husband, in, which was one of high excitement. Every time he came from the White House, he was on a sort of high." As for Roosevelt, he was convinced, quite firmly convinced, that the young congressman believed in the things he himself believed in. Moreover, Franklin Roosevelt's initial impression of Lyndon Johnson, the feeling that he was a most remarkable young man, had evidently been reinforced by familiarity. In the opinion of James Rowe, the presidential aide with the best opportunity to observe the interplay between Roosevelt and Johnson, the principal reason for the growing rapport between the two men was the president's belief that Johnson was not only committed, but capable. Johnson was in many ways just more capable than most of the people Roosevelt saw. We're talking about a very capable man. You've got to remember that they were two great political geniuses. The president told Anna Rosenberg Hoffman, who worked in congressional liaison for the White House, "I want you to work with that young congressman from Texas, Lyndon Johnson. He's a comer and he's a real liberal." The president tendered Johnson the ultimate compliment. He told Harold Ickes that Johnson was the kind of uninhibited young pro he would have liked to have been as a young man, and might have been if he hadn't gone to Harvard. And, Ickes recounted, Roosevelt had also said that in the next generation the balance of power would shift south and west, and this boy could well be the first Southern president. With older men who possessed power, Johnson had always been a professional son, utterly deferential. "Yes, sir. No, sir." Was this a technique that he employed on Roosevelt and that endeared him to the president? The only man I think he never quarreled with was Roosevelt. Maybe that was because he, Roosevelt, was always president, Rose says. With older men, moreover, he was always the most attentive of listeners. Was this a quality that endeared him to a man who loved to talk, and who, lonely, needed someone to talk to? Or was the crucial quality ability, that rare ability so many older men recognized? The reasons for the rapport between the president and the young congressman were, Roe emphasizes, complicated. Johnson, Roe says, used Roosevelt when he could, and, he says, Roosevelt knew he was being used. But whatever the reason, the rapport was there, and it was deep. Ever since he had arrived in Washington 9 years before, Lyndon Johnson had, first as a congressional secretary and then as a congressman, been touching every base, cultivating not only bureaucrats, but their secretaries and their assistants, and their assistants' assistants, and their secretaries, until entire government bureaus knew him, liked him, wanted to do things for him. He used the same technique with members of the White House staff. The basis of their friendliness toward him was their belief that he loved their chief as they did. The White House was filled with the fierce loyalty and warm affection that he, Roosevelt, inspired, Robert E. Sherwood wrote. If you could prove possession of these sentiments in abundance, you were accepted as a member of the family and treated accordingly. Marvin McIntyre, the soft touch among the presidential secretaries, had long been convinced that Johnson was a devout Roosevelt worshiper. But General Edwin M. Pa Watson, the presidential secretary who was now in charge of appointments, and was therefore official guardian of the door to the Oval Office, was, behind his amiable exterior, a much tougher customer, and had for a long time been notably immune to the Johnson charm. Now Pa, too, had been completely won over, as was demonstrated by a remark he made when Jim Roe was attempting to persuade him to give another congressman a few minutes of the president's time. "Is he like Lyndon?" Pa asked. "Is he a perfect Roosevelt man?" Friendly with two presidential secretaries, Johnson didn't neglect the third, cultivating Stephen T. Early at every opportunity. He didn't neglect anyone in the White House. The fight against Garner had certified his bona fides with Missy LaHand, Roosevelt's longtime personal secretary, but Missy had an assistant, Grace Tully, who took most of the president's dictation. She was a 40-ish spinster, and Johnson had always had particular success winning the friendship of such women. Now he devoted a great deal of effort to winning Miss Tully's, sometimes stopping by her apartment on Connecticut Avenue and giving her a lift to work. The effort was successful. So fond was she of him and so convinced of his loyalty to the man she was to call one of the great souls of history that she would later suggest, with a rather dramatic misunderstanding of Johnson's ambitions, that he be made a presidential secretary. This determination to touch every base paid dividends. Paul Watson guarded only the front door to the Oval Office. There was a back door, too. This was the door to the small, cluttered office, on the opposite side of the Oval Office from Watson's, that was shared by LaHand and Tully. Visitors Roosevelt wanted to see without the knowledge of the press, off-the-record guests in the parlance of the White House inner circle, would use this door, entering the White House by an unfrequented side entrance, then going up the back stairs to Missy's office to be ushered into the president's presence by her. This door was used as well by the knowledgeable young White House staffers because the two personal secretaries possessed virtually unlimited access to the president. Everyone had to go through Pa, except Missy and Grace, Corcoran recalls. If one of these two women knew Roosevelt was alone, she could bring someone in for a quick moment's discussion in which the president could give him the decision or guidance he needed. So if Pa wouldn't let you in, you went around back to Grace, and she or Missy got you in. A refinement of this procedure was also employed. If Roe, say, or one of the president's five other administrative assistants, the men with a passion for anonymity, whose offices were across narrow West Executive Avenue in the old State War and Navy building, asked Watson for an appointment with the president, he might be told that the schedule was filled, but that Watson would try, no guarantees, to fit him in between appointments if he wanted to wait with other visitors in his spacious anteroom. "And you'd sit there," says Roe, "and if Pa wouldn't let you in fast enough, you'd go out and go around back to Missy, and ask her, "When do I get in? I've got to talk to the president." Then you'd go back and sit in Pa's office again, and Missy would tell Roosevelt, and he would tell Pa, "I need to talk to Jim Rowe. Get him, will you?" And Pa would say, "He's right here." It was a game. This version of the game was used frequently by those of the young men the two women were fond of. "I learned. I always went in through the back door," Rose says, "and Lyndon got in, like me, through the back door." Fond though Watson was of Johnson, Paul was a vigilant guardian of the president's time, and had Johnson asked for more than occasional bits of it, he might easily have worn out his welcome with the general. So he used the more informal route, which is one reason his name seldom appears in the White House logs that chronicle the president's official visitors. Touching every base paid off in another way as well. The arrogant Corcoran habitually had Missy LeHand take him into the Oval Office and didn't bother paying much attention to other members of the presidential secretariat. But in 1941, for reasons never explained, Roosevelt dropped Tommy the Cork, and because Miss LeHand suffered a stroke, there was no one to get him in through the back door to repair the damage. One of the reasons that the break between the two men couldn't be restored, Rose suggests, was the fact that Corcoran always went through Missy, and Missy died. Lyndon Johnson would never make such a mistake. He had taken care to be friends not only with Miss LeHand, but with her assistant, and LeHand's illness did not close the back door to him. In fact, it was more open than ever, for Grace Tully was in some ways the easiest mark for the Johnson charm of anyone on Roosevelt's staff, and she was very useful to him. Not only would he personally hand to her a memo that he wanted the president to see so that she could put it on top of the pile, but he would, Rose says, tell Grace something that he didn't want to put in a memo. He would say, "Grace, will you tell him, but don't take any notes and don't tell anyone else." He didn't work only through Tully, of course. He didn't have to, so long as Rowe was his friend. Often he would visit Rowe in his office. Sometimes, since the president would be more likely to read a memo from Rowe than from him, his purpose would be to obtain Rowe's imprimatur on a Johnson proposal. He would come over, for example, if there was a memo he wanted to make sure Roosevelt saw. He would say, "I can't write. You write it. You do it for both of us." Johnson was a great man for "Jim Rowe and I think." Rowe and Johnson were quite close now. Their late-afternoon telephone conversations had become almost a custom, one that was not interrupted even when Johnson was in Texas, although when he initiated a long-distance call, he took care to have his secretary reverse the charges. Once, when a secretary neglected to do so in advance, Johnson told her that if she couldn't make some ex post facto arrangement to have the White House pay for the 30-minute call, she would have to pay for it herself. When Rowe didn't hear from Johnson for a few days, he missed him. Once he dropped Johnson a note. "There has been a deadly silence around here for some time. Miss Gilligan, Rowe's secretary, says it makes this office very dull. I got so worried about it last week I called to see if you had fallen in front of a train. I was relieved to find you were only in Texas." And as close as he was to Rowe, and hard as he worked to maintain that closeness, Rowe was not the only one of the president's six administrative assistants he was cultivating. When he ran up the stairs that pierced the forest of columns on the towering, grotesque facade of the State War and Navy Building, and then ran up an inside flight of stairs to Death Row, as the administrative assistants had dubbed their line of offices on the second floor, he might be heading for any of the six offices. And no matter which one he was heading for, he could be sure of a warm welcome in it. Part 6. Defeat. Chapter 34. Pass the biscuits, Pappy. Shortly after daylight, on April 9, 1941, the telephone rang in the Johnsons' Washington apartment. Walter Jenkins was telephoning from the police desk at the front door of the Cannon Building, where, he told Lyndon Johnson, he had just heard a startling piece of news. During the night, Maura Shepherd, the senior United States Senator from Texas, had died of a stroke. "Well, I won't be in this morning," Johnson said. Undersecretary of the Interior Alvin Wirtz was also wakened early that morning. His secretary, Mary Rather, got to their offices at Interior unusually early because she had heard the news, but when she opened the door to Wirtz's private office, there he was, already sitting at his desk. "Are you thinking what I'm thinking?" he asked. Soon he and Johnson were mapping strategy for a Johnson campaign to fill the seat that Shepard had held for 27 years. The principal obstacle to Johnson's candidacy was the one that had confronted him in his race for the House 4 years before. Most voters had never heard of him. The voters of his 10th congressional district knew him, of course, and so did the voters of the 14th, which he had earlier served as a congressional secretary. But in the state's other 19 congressional districts, his name was all but unknown. Shortly after Shepard's death, an East Texas radio station asked its listeners to send in postcards indicating the name of their favorite candidate. Not one of the hundreds of replies bore the name of Lyndon Johnson. There were, moreover, potential candidates whose names were household words throughout Texas. The state's governor, W. Lee O'Daniel, its youthful attorney general, Gerald C. Mann, Congressman Martin Dies, chairman of the House Committee on Un-American Activities. A Belden poll, the Texas version of the Gallup poll, taken shortly after Shepard's death, showed that 33% of the state's voters favored O'Daniel in a Senate race, 26% Mann, 9% Dies, and 5% Johnson. Johnson's best hope of overcoming this handicap was the same strategy that had worked so well in 1937, linking his name with a name that was still magic in the state. Just 6 months before, Franklin D. Roosevelt had crushed Wilkie in Texas by a margin of more than 4-1. Strong reasons existed for the president's active support of a liberal in the special election that would be held to fill Shepard's seat. He obviously didn't want either Dies, the Garner protege whose committee had begun investigating New Deal agencies, or the conservative isolationist O'Daniel in the Senate. A memo circulating in the White House warned that the election of either is a possibility too frightful for contemplation. But there was also a reason, a very strong reason, why the liberal should not be Lyndon Johnson, but Gerald Mann. Mann was an ardent New Dealer. Although he had never met the president, Jerry was a Roosevelt worshiper, an aide recalls. He had, in fact, worked for Johnson in 1937 because of Johnson's all-out support of the New Deal. And Mann had a much better chance to win than Johnson did. A small-town boy who worked on farms and in a local hotel to earn money to attend Southern Methodist University in Dallas, the slender, speedy back was twice named to all-conference football teams and became famous throughout Texas as SMU's Little Red Arrow. He possessed three enthusiasms somewhat rare among politicians: for God, for poetry, and for the law as an abstract force that could promote the general good. Determined to study at the best law school in the country, he took his wife and baby son to Melrose, Massachusetts, where, while commuting to Harvard Law School, he worked two shifts a day in a garment factory, until parishioners of the Congregationalist Church in Gloucester, impressed by the Sunday school sermons of the intense, handsome young man, made him their pastor. Thanks to football, he had entered politics with a statewide reputation, and in public office he had burnished it. Returning to Texas from Harvard, he had become one of Governor James Allred's assistant attorney generals and had produced some notably progressive legislation, including a revision of Sam Johnson's now outdated Blue Sky Law, and then had been Ed Clark's predecessor as Secretary of State. In 1938, at the age of 31, he had run for Attorney General. Finishing second to an experienced and popular politician in the first primary, Mann overtook him in the runoff and beat him by an astonishing 130,000 votes. Replacing the political hacks in the Attorney General's office with bright young lawyers, Mann raised its notoriously low standards, waged what Texas historian Seth McKay calls continuous war against loan sharks and usurious finance companies, and most significantly, instituted strict enforcement of the state's antitrust laws, hitherto all but ignored by state administrations subservient to business interests. During his first two-year term, scores of antitrust suits were filed, and a substantial portion were won. So popular was he that when, in 1940, he ran for re-election, no one ran against him. 34 years old, already twice elected to statewide office, he was, in 1941, by far the best-known and most respected young public official in Texas. A brilliant career was predicted for him in Texas politics, McKay writes, and when Shepard died, several of the state's leading newspapers spontaneously joined in asking him to run for the Senate. O'Daniel had said he wasn't running. If the immensely popular governor entered the race, Mann had the best chance to beat him. If O'Daniel stayed out, a Belden poll showed, he would beat Dyes, although the vote would be close. The only way Dyes could win, in fact, was if another New Dealer, such as Lyndon Johnson, entered the race and split the New Deal vote. A little deceit was necessary to offset this reasoning. Roosevelt and the White House staff knew little about the internal politics of Texas, of course, as had been amply demonstrated the year before. In 1941, as in 1940, most of the information given to the president about Texas came from Johnson and Wirtz, and from Johnson's admirers on the White House staff, whose information, of course, came mostly from him. This information was not strictly accurate. The president was told that Mann possessed neither guaranteed loyalty to the New Deal nor the statewide reputation necessary to defeat Dyes, or O'Daniel, should the governor choose to run. A Johnson-inspired memo told Roosevelt that Mann was unbranded and unknown. Several influential Texans, including Senator Tom Connally, tried to explain the true situation to Roosevelt, but the president's fondness for Johnson predisposed him to be convinced by his arguments. Roosevelt, who had, following the 1938 purge attempt, readopted his pose of never intervening in an intrastate Democratic fight, orchestrated a scenario designed to show, without his actually saying so, that he was intervening in this one. He arranged for Johnson to see him on April 22nd, just before his regular Tuesday press conference, so that arriving reporters would see Johnson emerging from the Oval Office. While the reporters watched, Johnson announced his candidacy from the White House steps, saying he would campaign under the banner of Roosevelt. And when the reporters, crowding into the Oval Office, asked the president if he had given Johnson permission to wave that banner, Roosevelt replied, "First, it is up to the people of Texas to elect the man they want as their senator. Second, everybody knows that I cannot enter a primary election. And third, to be truthful, all I can say is that Lyndon Johnson is a very old, old friend of mine." Then, as Time magazine put it, the correspondents laughed, and he laughed with them. "FDR picks Johnson to defeat Dyes," said the headline in the Dallas Morning News. In 1941, as in 1937, therefore, the Johnson campaign consisted of a single issue: Roosevelt, Roosevelt, Roosevelt. That issue was emphasized in the candidate's speeches. What America needed, he said, was Roosevelt and unity, unity under one management and for a common purpose, saving America from the dangers ahead. United behind Roosevelt, we'll save America from the threat of slavery by the Axis. If he was elected, he said, he would be 100% for Roosevelt, an all-out Roosevelt senator, just a private under my commander-in-chief. The issue was symbolized by his campaign emblem, the picture of Roosevelt and Johnson shaking hands on the Galveston dock at their first meeting 4 years before. In that picture, then-Governor Allred had been standing between the two men, but now he was airbrushed out. What remained was two tall, smiling men shaking hands across the empty space where Allred had once stood. This image was used in countless brochures and campaign newspapers, and painted larger than life, it was plastered on thousands of billboards along highways the length and breadth of Texas. And not only the busy roads leading into Dallas and Houston and El Paso, the state's great empty spaces were not ignored. Before a driver speeding across the vast flat plains of West Texas or the Panhandle, those two huge figures shaking hands, painted dark against a red, white, and blue background, would loom up against the sky miles ahead. The issue was summed up in the campaign's slogan, which had originally been a private password used with a grin among the chief's NYA boys who were out campaigning for him, but which was so catchy that it quickly became the campaign's public motto as well, appearing in new editions of the brochures and campaign newspapers, and on hundreds of thousands of hastily printed red, white, and blue bumper stickers, simple and to the point: Franklin D. and Lyndon B. This time, the man whose name Johnson was invoking played an active role in the race. Ignorance of Texas politics may partially explain Roosevelt's original decision to support Johnson, but it does not explain the extent or the enthusiasm of his support. As if his press conference hint had not been sufficiently broad, leaks went out from the White House to sympathetic columnists. "Roosevelt has a fatherly interest in young Johnson," Pearson and Allen wrote, said Alsop and Kintner. "Although overburdened with the huge war effort and facing the gravest decision in this country's history, the president still takes a personal interest in the campaign of his protege, Representative Lyndon B. Johnson. intimates disclose that the president and his small group of advisers are receiving regular reports on the campaign, and that the president has lost none of his determination to give Johnson every aid. As much as any candidate in recent years, Johnson is running under the White House banner. The president's support went beyond hints and leaks. Johnson wanted Vice President Wallace's aide, Harold H. Young, the burly, brilliant Dallas attorney, seconded to his campaign for its duration. The vice president refused to let Young go. The president intervened, and when Johnson flew down to Texas to open the campaign, Young was sitting beside him on the plane. Johnson had asked which Department of Agriculture officials could best help him, and Roosevelt apparently said he would find out. Informed that they were Milo Perkins, Maston White, and Assistant Secretary of Agriculture Grover Hill, the president sent Rowe a memo. "Will you pass the word on to Lyndon Johnson and do the necessary?" The necessary was a direct order to the three men delivered by Rowe to give Johnson any help he wanted. Rowe had been designated liaison between the White House and Johnson's camp. One of his first tasks was to ensure that Johnson received credit for all federal spending in Texas. He says, "Word went out from me to all departments in Washington. No projects approved for Texas unless Lyndon Johnson is notified." In cases in which Rowe did not possess sufficient forcefulness, a more forceful man stepped in. Thomas Corcoran wouldn't be White House Tommy much longer, but in April 1941 he could still use the magic words that had given him that nickname, and he used them on behalf of Lyndon Johnson. On the very day Johnson left for Texas, he requested approval of a certain rural electrification project, asking for its approval before he left. An REA official said such rapid action was simply impossible. The phone rang in the official's office. "This is Tommy Corcoran at the White House. Congressman Johnson wants this today, and the White House wants him to have it today." Not only had Rowe, Corcoran, and other Roosevelt aides been told to help Johnson, but their fondness for Johnson and their fear of an O'Daniel or Dyes victory made them eager to help him. Harold Ickes took the trouble to telephone Dyes' hometown himself to check on whether the congressman had paid his real estate taxes. "Everybody was helping him," Rowe says, "and I'm thinking of all the liberals all the way." Their feelings are summed up in a memorandum from Pa Watson, who felt Lyndon was the perfect Roosevelt man. On a letter from a Texas politician critical of Johnson, Watson wrote, "Referred to Secretary Ickes for his perusal and then the ash can." The on-the-scene beneficiary of all this help was Walter Jenkins, who had been left behind in Washington when John Connally and Herbert Henderson left for Texas to work in the campaign. When Johnson needed something from the federal agencies, it was Jenkins who had to visit the officials involved. The shy 23-year-old had no experience doing this. "I had been answering mail," he says, filling constituents' requests for farming pamphlets, when he wasn't directing tourists around the Cannon Building in his guard's uniform. Suddenly, he had to deal with Steve Early, Missy LeHand, Grace Tully, Jim Rowe, and the legendary Corcoran. When Johnson told him his new assignment, he was at first scared, nervous. "But," he says, "I received a wonderful reception. It was just unbelievable to me." Tommy the Cork couldn't have been nicer. "I talked to him lots of times. He was still very powerful, and when you asked him something, he could do it." Even the old curmudgeon was nice. Once, Johnson told Jenkins to see Secretary Ickes personally about some matter too sensitive to be broached over the telephone, "and I remember thinking I couldn't possibly get to see Ickes." But Ickes's office returned his call immediately and said the secretary could see him immediately. "I was very excited," Jenkins says. And when he told Ickes what Johnson needed, Ickes said that Johnson would have it. No matter what he asked these officials to do, Jenkins says, they did it. In fact, in many cases, he didn't have to ask. The White House would often call him about something we hadn't even asked about. "I think that Mr. Roosevelt had put the word out to do anything possible to help Lyndon Johnson, within reason, and sometimes beyond reason. He, Roosevelt, wanted Mr. Johnson to win so bad." There were other similarities between Johnson's first campaign for the Senate and his first campaign for the House. In 1941, as in 1937, only he, among all the candidates, possessed an efficient campaign organization. Although it was, of course, much larger than the 1937 organization, it was in many respects the same organization. From top, Undersecretary Alvin Wirtz directed campaign strategy from his desk in the Department of the Interior, to Bottom. Carol Keach was again Johnson's chauffeur. The Henderson brothers were again on hand. Herb, the genius with a pencil, to write speeches, Chuck to write letters as the man in charge of communication with potential voters. The organization came primarily from the National Youth Administration, and many of the key names on the roster of the Johnson campaign workers of 1941, Kellum, Deason, Ernest Morgan, Fenner Roth, were the names of 1937. John Connolly took orders from Wirtz and ran campaign headquarters in Austin. It was an organization not only young, energetic, and capable, but devoted to its leader. When someone sneered at Carol Keach for again being only Johnson's chauffeur, Keach replied simply, "Everyone can do something for him. This is what I can do for him." The weeding out begun by Johnson when he had been NYA director had continued under Kellum, and the NYA was composed now of men who had proven the hard way that they were willing to work, willing to take orders, and able to get things done. They were bound to Johnson, as they had always been, by the force of his personality. Fenner Roth named his son after his chief, as well as by self-interest. In 1941, their investment in his future was 4 years greater than in 1937, and this time the stakes were much bigger. J.J. Jake Pickle, perhaps the most capable of the post-1937 recruits, had no hesitation about quitting his NYA job for a lower-paying campaign job, in part because, well, it was expected that you would get your job back after the campaign. But mostly because I felt at this time that Mr. Johnson had the prospects of being a state and national figure, and he'd take you along with him. It was a good gamble to do it. It was the best way to get ahead. It was an organization in place, and its individual members knew their place. The NYA was, after all, a well-organized going concern. It was, in effect, shifted virtually en masse to the Johnson campaign. And, as in all Johnson operations, there was an ironclad chain of command, a chain that carried over into the campaign. Superimposed above the NYA boys were Wirtz, Connolly, and James Blundell, a former Garner supporter who had seen where the future lay, had switched to the New Deal, and was now Connolly's assistant. But the organization below, the organization that carried out the daily campaigning, was largely the NYA organization. The state was divided into districts along the lines of the NYA districts, and an NYA director supervised each and gave orders to local NYA men who were familiar with smaller areas. And because the NYA was a statewide organization, Johnson's campaign organization was a statewide organization, the first statewide political organization Texas had ever seen. Johnson's insistence that his NYA workers meet and cultivate local officials would pay off now. The mayors and county commissioners whose support he needed would be contacted by men who were already their friends. Within a week after his campaign had begun, 12 two-man teams had fanned out from Austin across Texas to carry the message of Roosevelt and unity. And these teams knew whom to see. Having worked in the 1937 campaign, moreover, they knew many little tricks of the political trade. Wingate Lucas knew he was in the hands of professionals from the moment the Johnson team of advance men arrived in his hometown to oversee his preparations for a Johnson speech. The audience was going to sit on a hillside, and Lucas's aides had been setting up the chairs right next to each other. And his people said, "You never put the chairs so close together at a political rally. You want to make it look like there are more people there." They removed every other chair. "We spread those chairs across the whole hillside." The press reported that Johnson had drawn a larger audience than in fact he had. "Now that sounds like a simple thing," Lucas says, "but at the time I didn't know that." And in 1941, as in 1937, Johnson had money. This book is continued on cassette number 6, side 1.